there's a broad sweeping movement of people trying to get away from earned income and move to passive income.
If it's not possible to live on your own means, then we're backsliding.
If the only way to reach that steady state happiness for the person is to be involved in a growth-like system, I think that's a dangerous thing to hinge your economy on.
Oh, anyone should be able to work 40 hours a week and get what they need? Disagree.
Philosophers. So, David, I kind of have a topic for today.
Okay.
Although I don't really know what we're going to call this topic. But I got economics questions, and I'm going to be showing my ignorance today.
Excellent.
Because I'm not an economist. I am not studied in the economy arts.
I took economics 101 years ago.
All right, so you're practically an expert. You are definitely qualified to write articles about economics. But there's a couple things that I've just been thinking about, and I feel like this is just a good vented out episode where I get to be ignorant on a mic. And I think it's important to do that from time to time. So highly recommend it. It's humbling. So I think this all kind of centers around like some disillusionment maybe I have with, I don't want to just say broader economics, but like the business world and capital and funding and how that all works with quality of life stuff. And, you know, may or may not come off the back of some reality checking personally about like, how much money do I need to make to just to be good, like I'm set, you know, for life. And how does that all work out? You know what I mean? Because I think the default setting a lot of people come with is, well, you need to make as much money as possible. And that's not a terrible default setting for seeking employment and asking for raises and getting different jobs, you know?
Right. Well, and I think, yeah, the threshold is relatively high for where making more money doesn't do anything else for you.
Yeah.
Right. So for most people, making another dollar is better, like is noticeably better than not.
Yeah.
But there is a threshold past which it's like, okay, this is all just an abstract, money has become an abstract concept to me. I have all my needs fulfilled. I get everything I want. I don't think about it anymore. And I have so much of it, in fact, that I pay other people to make sure that I keep making it. And I don't even work a job anymore.
Right. And I feel like for most people, and I know I'm for sure at least this way, if you start out in life making very little money, it's always, man, if I just made 15% more, I could buy the things that I want to buy, because you know what your costs are.
Right. Yeah. Most people have a steady state in their life right now, right?
Yeah.
So they're making enough money to pay their bills for a place to live, basic utilities, clothes to wear, and food to eat. And like for most folks, a car to drive and fuel to get at places.
Right.
Enough to do your job until the next paycheck at least, and then do it again.
Right.
So if only I made 15% more, then I would just be able to pocket that and do whatever I want, right? I could continue living my current life that I am living on X dollars and X plus 15%, while I can still spend the X dollars doing what I'm doing now and have that extra for me.
Yeah. And I think that, and to be fair, I think this is a stage. There's a prior stage to this. This is kind of like a post-consumerism stage where you kind of don't care anymore about the newest whatever, or maybe you are making enough money to be like, I want to have the newest phone every year. Well, that's a fixed-ish cost, you know, repetitive cost.
Mm-hmm.
But you can make enough money to afford that every year, and then the box is checked. Cool, you know. You kind of have to reach a point where it's like, I don't actually need a bunch of stuff. Like, advertising still works on me to some degree, but it's like, I really don't care to have a sports car. You know what I mean? Like, I could.
I don't need the nicest of everything I have, right?
Right.
I don't need to live in a giant mansion. Yeah, I don't need a super fast, you know, ultra cool sports car to go impress people. You know, I move past that. Yeah, or whatever. And yeah, I don't want to eat at 5-star restaurants every night. Like,
right. And I think, yeah, the stage before this is, well, there's like the first stage, which is I'm hungry. And
yes,
I would like to be able to,
I would like to be not hungry.
I'd like to be not hungry. And I think that's very few people, at least in the West, but that is a stage for some people.
Mm-hmm.
The stage after that is I would like to know that I'm going to have a place to live a year from now. Like, I want to feel confident and secure that I'm going to have a place to live and that I can afford it. My bills need to at least be covered, but I may not be able to do very much. Then up from there, it's kind of like this stage where all my regular expenses are covered, but I'm still chasing the consumerism dream of like, there's just all these things
to be better. Yeah.
The laundry list of things I want to buy far exceeds my spending ability. And so any more money I can make to buy the things that I want would be great. And like, I'll never get there. And I think what ends up happening when you get to this stage is that it's a mixture of two things. One, you do end up making enough money to buy some of the things that you really want that are important, but you also kind of no longer, being content is now more important than having more, right?
Right.
And that's a weird moment to get to, because I think it also happens to occur around the time when you've already, like, you've struggled to get to this point, right? You've struggled fighting through the different jobs, figuring out what you're, like, you have to have figured out at least what people are willing to pay you at this point, right? Because I think that's like a big hurdle that people have to get over before they get here, which is you only see what you could earn from your perspective, not what someone would be willing to pay, which are very different things.
Yes.
Like,
the first step to understanding money is understanding why you earn what you earn today.
And I think this comes in the form of, usually for most people, and this is why I do recommend this being a thing, figuring out a colleague that does the same work as you makes significantly more than you.
Right.
That is one of the biggest eye-opening moments of, wait a minute, you're making how much?
I'm getting screwed right now.
I'm being screwed. Yeah, like that. That's a huge eye-opening moment for people. And once you're aware of it, you can't unsee it. And you start questioning every salary that you're offered. And you realize, and I think that's when the suspicion first arises, and then it like hits home when you go apply for, because you usually can't get it at the same job you're at. Most people will go apply for a job at a different place, and they'll, with shaky hand, write down the salary they actually want, or they think is a lot.
And they think they're going to get laughed out of the room for asking for.
And they immediately say yes, and didn't even counteroffer.
It's like, oh, I could have gotten way more then.
Yeah. How many years have I spent earning? Like, I'm going to use some real numbers just to give some context.
Sure.
But, you know, making $45,000 a year is a lot of money to someone who is making minimum wage.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so you're very happy to accept that salary. And you may even be super grateful to your employer for that. And then 2 years go by and your lifestyle adjusts to $45,000 and you're still chasing the dream. So you're like, well, I'd like to make more. And then you go look online or you hear it from a coworker, you discover that people are making significantly more than that. And it's like, oh, but $90,000 is just so much money. I don't know that I could ever make that much
money.
How do you even ask someone to do that? And how do I not get left out of the room? But then you put that, or even worse, in some cases, you just get an offer that is more than that. And then you feel stupid forever considering that to be too much money. And then you have your next baller moment where you're like, I have doubled my income. I am so set for life right now. I could just do this forever until I die.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because I think that's another kind of truism, is that as your income increases, thus shall your costs, for whatever reason.
Yes. This is a phenomenon called lifestyle creep.
Mm-hmm.
In which, yeah, as soon as you start making more money, you may initially, okay, if we assume you are an educated person, you understand the basics of how money works, you know how to make like a budget or whatever, and you've been making it on a low salary so far, and then you get a humongous raise, like doubling your salary. In the beginning, yes, you will just be pocketing a bunch of new money coming in, but, you know, well, especially for the first paycheck, you're like, man, I just got the biggest paycheck I've ever received. This is, you know, 2 months' pay in 1 month.
Honey, get the kids. We're going out for a steak dinner.
You right. Know what we're I mean? Doing, yeah, something like that. We're going out for a treat to celebrate what I've done, right?
Yep.
And soon enough, you're having celebrations every week.
Well, and ads that you just like filtered out of your vision because it's like, who would ever buy a $25 steak? Or like, I remember for me, the moment was, because growing up, I remember my father saying, who would spend $10 on a meal?
Right.
That's insane. And I remembered for the longest time going out to eat and thinking $10
for a
meal.
For a meal is outrageous.
That is a nice meal. Yeah. And we're going to pretend for a moment that inflation doesn't exist because that makes it all worse. This exacerbates everything we're going to mm-hmm. talk about.
Yes.
But then when all of a sudden you can afford to eat $20 in a meal and like it just becomes a thing you can do and just starts to happen more and you're like, yeah, I got out of there for like $20 a person. That was pretty reasonable. And you start seeing ads for things that are now attainable.
I mean, it could be that. I'm sort of thinking of my own psychology. So my own psychological tendencies that pull me to waste money. Or maybe not even waste money, but spend money less responsibly.
Please spend responsibly.
It is the deep temptation of just this once.
Oh no.
Yeah. It's like, okay, I know this is outside the budget, but I do actually have the money right now for this thing.
Yeah.
I won't do it again. Except that I will do it again.
Yep.
Because next time I also want a thing that's like, well, just this once. And now I've done it twice.
another one for me is the, well, if you buy a quality one, I'd rather spend a little...
Buy once, cry once.
Buy once, cry once. And to be
fair... So I will start buying nicer things than I otherwise would have, yeah.
And I think the real creep... Because hear me out. That actually can be a good idea.
Buy once, cry once is good for a lot of things.
But not everything.
No.
And that's where it becomes a problem is when you look at like... You know, I could buy... I want a soda. Like this happens to me. Mm-hmm. I want a soda. I did this today. I have a drink in front of me, right? You'll notice that I've had two of these.
Yes.
I bought two. You know why? They were on sale. Or if you could buy two, they were cheaper.
Mm-hmm.
Now...
But you spent more money than just buying one.
But I still spent more money. And I think this is the one that, like, I don't mean to be sexist or anything, but this is my lived experience growing up in a, like, my parents were very traditional, whatever, you know, where my mother was largely unemployed for most of my mm-hmm. life. Not always, but largely. This is, like, I think the trap that gets people sucked into it is, like,
I know exactly where you're going.
Yeah, look at how much money I saved.
Yeah, think of the savings.
Think
but you
of the
didn't
savings.
Save any money. You spent more money than you otherwise would have spent if they didn't have the sale. But that's exactly why they put things on sale.
But at the bottom of the receipt, I saved $80.
But you didn't.
No, you actually
spent an extra $100. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But when you have more money, you think you're being better with your money that way. And like I said...
Sales are good when you were already going to do that anyway, right?
Yes.
It's like, cool, I'll take advantage of this. Or, you know, if it's something that, okay, I know I'm going to consume this anyway, right? If I can do the buy two for cheaper toothpaste tubes, yeah, I'm going to do that because I'm going to end up using that anyway.
Right.
So this actually is savings because I will use both of those tubes of toothpaste at some point.
Right. If you can afford to go to the big box store and buy cases of things you're going to eventually consume, then yes, it is better.
Right.
But what's, I think, creeping about that... And I'm a victim of this. I can buy 30 packs of Coke Zeros, mm-hmm. right? Or I could buy bottles.
Not sponsored,
but Coke. I would. I don't know how you feel about it. I'd like Coke sponsor this. Pepsi, you're going to have to make a really much more competitive offer, but otherwise you can get bent. but I would drink maybe two cans of soda a day if I had to buy them individually. But if I can afford a 30 pack, I'll drink four or five.
That's the thing. The availability of more leads to it enables you to consume more.
Yes. Yeah. And
because like, yeah, you got the two sodas today for cheaper per unit than just buying the one, but you drank both of them today.
I would have also just
you didn't
drank
buy
the
one for today and one for tomorrow. You bought two for today.
Right. And that's a part of it too. But yeah, it's and I think that's kind of how it happens. And buy once, cry once works for some things, but like not all things, you know.
Yeah. So here's some advice. A place where buy once, cry once reigns supreme and gets people to spend a lot of money on things that they really didn't need to spend that much money on: tools. Tools can get very expensive. And there are reasons why you might need to get a nicer tool. But I think the advice that I have appreciated is the first time that you ever need to use a tool, you should buy something cheap.
Harbor Freight.
Harbor Freight. Not our sponsor. Boys at Harbor Freight. And also not sponsored. Harbor Freight. Does Harbor Freight even have money to sponsor?
I mean, they run those outrageous coupon ads all the
That's
time.
That's true. My mailbox is full of Harbor Freight coupons. So I don't know how much money they're spending on paper for that. Anyway, so yeah, go to Harbor Freight first and get some cheap piece of junk thing to...
Yeah, my linear saw.
Yeah, looking over there at the Harbor Freight tool that you recently bought.
Yeah.
So anyway, do that first. And if it breaks, you know you use it enough that it's worth getting a good one.
Mm-hmm.
Then buy once, cry once.
Yep. Which, it's kind of not buy once, cry once because you did buy it twice, but...
But you learned that you actually did need it. Instead of, like, okay, yeah, but you could initially spend like twice as much on the nice one that won't break and it just sits in your garage and collects dust forever because you didn't actually need it. You needed it for that one job that time and then you never had a use for it again.
Right. And I think this, another application of this is more universally applicable as furniture. I mean, half the furniture I've purchased in my life I've either built myself or I've purchased at a flea market. But the few pieces of furniture that I've actually gone out and spent a lot of money on are the ones that wear out the most. And you don't, and it's surprising which ones that is too, because you would think, well, obviously like maybe your couch or whatever, the thing you sit on all the time, but maybe not. Maybe it's your kitchen table. Maybe it's your dining room chairs. You don't know, but this is a good way to say, I'm going to get what I need today, be economical today. And then when it finally starts to wear out, it's like, okay, I clearly use this a lot. You know, it, I, and also I think if you pair this with a save up for certain things in a budget strategy, even if you don't need to maintain them normally, or they're not something that you regularly spend on, I think having a budget, like having a furniture budget, is a weird thing to have because it's going to accumulate a lot of money before it's actually used. And it may seem unintuitive. It's like, how often do I need to be buying furniture? But if you're going to feel really good about it 3 years from now, when you do need to finally replace a couch, and you can go buy the $1,200 couch as opposed to the $300 couch at the discount store that's made out of cheap Chinesium that's going to break in like 6 months, especially if you're a fatty like me who drinks five cans of Coke Zero a day, you know. But I think, yeah, so there's all that. And what I got to thinking about, like I was driving the other day and I was thinking about like how many trucks I pass on the freeway. And just in my head, it occurred to me that like everybody you see in the day-to-day life, we're all on this spectrum somewhere, right? Mm-hmm. Everybody in existence, and there's stages beyond what we've talked about, but we're all on this somewhere, and it's just strange to me to think that, like, I'm earning so much money doing whatever I'm doing. This truck driver is earning so much money for doing what he's doing, and we all kind of contribute into this economic system that allows us, we're trading our services for money that we are then using that money to spend on other services and goods, and that's the cyclical.
Right, so everything is circulating, and that's an economy, yeah.
Yeah, the economy, yeah, I almost said. But like the truck driver makes different amounts of money than I do, and I make different amounts of money than my boss and whatever. But what would happen if like all of a sudden we could magically will prices to be such that if you could make arbitrary number, you could reach the stage I'm talking about where it's like I'm good. Or you reach kind of this stage in your life where I don't care as much about making more money. I kind of care more about how I'm using my time not making money. Because up to this stage, all the stages we mentioned earlier, it's a good argument to make to say, well, maybe you should invest more of your time making money. Because you can't afford anything anyway, so you're not doing anything.
Mm-hmm.
So you might as well work more to make more money so that when you do have a little bit of spare time, you can actually afford to do something, or you can move up to be making enough money. When you make enough money to where it's like, I'm actually good. I don't, you know, I could get a bigger house. I could get another car. I could get, you know, different than soda. I could get energy drinks or whatever. Like, but it all kind of starts to feel somewhat frivolous. And I don't know, this is obviously like depends on the person, right? You know, different people have, I think, different ideal states of being. And if you look at, I think, salaries over time for most people, there's like a sheer climb for the first like 10 years of your employable life. And then it kind of plateaus off with small bumps up from there. And then it drops to almost zero when you retire, as far as your income goes. It's not a linear climb where you make $10 an hour and then 5 years later you're making 20 and then 40 and then 80 and then, you know, it's, or like 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60. No. It's not, that's not how it works. And people's lifestyles don't do that either. A lot of people, once they get to the point where they can afford a home that's big enough for them and their family, one or maybe two cars even, and you can afford to take two vacations a year and feed yourself, feed your family, be able to replace your appliances when you need to, and have some money back for an emergency. The argument for, you know, if you just stayed and worked an extra hour, like if you think about it in an overtime way, you know, when I was younger, if overtime was on the table, I'm taking it because I want more money. But now it's like, and I think some people get to this point where they're like, I could do overtime, but I'm good. I would rather spend money than make money.
Right.
And that's like the tipping point where it's, and when I say spend money, you don't actually have to spend it, but
not earn money.
Not earn, but you are constantly expending money, kind of.
Yeah, in an abstract way, yes. Yeah, I mean, yeah, I think there definitely is a point, especially in the white collar world. Like after 5 o'clock, I'm done, right? I'm on my own time now, and everybody else needs to leave me alone.
Or at the very least, it's Saturday.
Right.
That's the, I think, the thing before that, because even blue collar workers will appreciate it's Saturday. Leave me alone.
Leave me alone. Yeah.
Yeah. Saturday and Sunday. Like, I want my weekends. And it doesn't matter how much more you would pay me. It's actually just not worth, really, at this point. Especially if
you're, yeah, I might come in for a couple more hours during the week, but leave me alone on Saturday.
Right.
Yeah. This is my day off. Yeah. So, sure. So, okay. So, what's the problem then?
See, I don't even know that there is necessarily a problem. I just think that the thing that I'm looking at that you maybe could say is the problem is that, are there enough jobs out there for, and so far all we've discussed is earned income, right? I think more so now than ever, especially in the West, there's a broad sweeping movement of people trying to get away from earned income and move to passive, I'm putting air quotes around this, passive income, which isn't actually a type of income. It's a grouping of other types of income in my mind. There's profit income, there's appreciation income, you know, there's these other different kinds of income that we all group together as passive income. But the idea is that I'm not selling hours of my time for money. I'm just accumulating this money for some other reason. And I think the reason there's such a large emphasis on it is this is kind of the bar you can get to, how you get to the stage in your life where you can decide to be at the point where it's like, I don't actually need any more money. I think it's becoming less attainable to get there through purely earned income. Whereas for a long time, and this is what, if you listen to any baby boomer talk for any more than 5 minutes, they love to talk about how they just had their job at the factory and their earned income was enough to afford a living comfortably. And then they did that till they got their pension and then they quit and then they retired. Right. And if you listen to Zoomers or millennials long enough, you'll hear the disillusionment with that because that's not enough to achieve the stage in life that I'm talking about. And there's maybe more than one reason for this. Maybe that stage of life is more expensive than it used to be, or maybe you can't actually effectively earn enough income for that. And I don't know that it's necessary. It's a problem in the sense that I think most people would agree that it would be nice to be able to achieve that with purely earned income. And I don't know. I think I hear the argument all the time that your earned income should be enough. And like, there's something in me, I don't know if it's my blue collar upbringing, that says that that should be enough. Right. Or a good economic system is one that is enough, because that's like very intuitive way of thinking. Like, it's, I do thing for you, you give me money, is a very intuitive thing for most people.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and ultimately, yeah, I mean, the place where that comes from is if we think about like a world pre-economy, right?
Mm-hmm.
Everyone gets by their own means, right?
Sure.
And society is kind of that, just scaled up, right? There's people doing stuff and there's people buying stuff. And ultimately, this has to come out in the wash. It has to all add up, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or else, because if it's not possible to live on your own means, then we're backsliding, right?
There's deficit.
The society is losing wealth because people are working, they're spending all their time, and they're not getting enough for even themselves.
Yeah. If you were to step back and look at it way too simplified, we're generating and we're consuming. If generation cannot keep up with consumption, your economy's in backslide. That's a problem.
Right.
And all the economic systems I think we discuss in this podcast, they're all just trying to achieve making generation bigger to match consumption.
Mm-hmm.
And there's just different ways you can try to do that. But at the end of the day, that's ultimately what's going on in the circulation game. The circulation is things coming in and things going out, and then things that are going around in that before they eventually find their way out. You know, a great example of this is I might be able to, like, a skilled craftsman can build a chair, mm-hmm. right? That's the generation point, kind of. Although you could argue that the generation point was actually cutting down the trees.
Cutting the timber, yep.
Whatever. You can kind of go all the way back. But for the sake of my argument, this is the generation point for chair in the chair channel of the economy.
Mm-hmm.
But that chair is going to get circulated where it's going to go to me. I'm going to buy it. And the money that I generated probably came from doing something else, but it now is put into chair. But I can then sell chair later for either more or less money. Doesn't matter. And it moves around until eventually the chair breaks or the chair gets destroyed.
I was going to say, or we can just, for simplicity's sake, assume you hold on to it until it's destroyed. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's the simplest path. But to demonstrate the fact that circulating happens.
Well, the point of circulating is, okay, the lumberjack cut down a tree and sold that to a mill who turned that into boards, who sold that to the
carpenter.
The carpenter who turned it into a chair and sold it to you. And money is changing hands through each of these steps.
Right.
Eventually, it reaches its final resting place where someone uses it until it's destroyed. It's no longer usable. Yeah, you could repair it, but eventually it's just going to fall apart and not be worth it, so it gets thrown away. But all the while, every single person in this chain did work to earn some money, and then they spent that money on the thing that came before.
Right.
But yeah, things are coming into the economy when the lumberjack cuts down the timber, and they're going out of the economy when you destroy your chair.
Right.
Yeah, and ultimately, this needs to be at a steady state, because it kind of needs to be at a steady state. It depends on what the population is doing, actually. Because if there's more people being born, then the demand is going to go up. So production needs to go up to match that.
Sure.
But eventually there is a steady state for all of this where it's like, okay, population isn't getting any bigger, or it can't get any bigger for some reason. If we're making too much, then we're just flooding the world with stuff that nobody needs. And if we're not making enough, then people aren't getting what they need.
Right. And then again, see any economic system for how they address those situations, right? Mm-hmm. But I guess the thing that I'm looking at is that the assumption here in the model is that I want to use that model and also apply the model of the stages I mentioned before, you know, as drivers. Because ideally, one other thing you can do to shift, because demand is not necessity, right? I think that's the important thing here. People will demand things that they don't need, and that also drives the economy. And I'm not taking a unilateral view of it and saying that, you know, supply is finite necessarily. It is, but not in the way that I mean here, where it's like, just because we're building iPhones does not mean that we can't. Farms did not shrink so that iPhones could be made.
No.
That's what I mean by saying it's not finite in that way. It's just different. Ultimately, the resources are finite, but we are so not even close to using the maximum amount of resources that are available.
Right.
Yet, even rarer ones, we're still, you know, people, like, it's kind of funny to go back and look at like media that was created from like the 80s, there was a huge fear in the 80s over running out of oil.
Right, because people noticed we were using a whole lot of it. And like, we're very dependent on it at the time, and still are.
Yeah.
And they were like, well, it would be some kind of a disaster if we just ran out of this stuff.
Yep.
Yeah.
And the models at the time vastly underestimated the amount of oil and petroleum that existed.
Right.
But what changed with that now is we don't hear those concerns anymore. Like, it's no longer about we're going to run out.
It's that we need to stop using it for other reasons. Yeah.
Right. Because since then, we've discovered that there's actually vastly amounts more of petroleum that exists that we could actually run for a very long time, even seeing the rise in our consumption. That could still continue for a very long time. But now there's a different reason why we want to get off of it. But that's just to give an example.
Yeah, now we're not worried about running out. We're worried about using too much. Yeah.
The byproducts of that. Yes. Yeah. So that's an example. But like what people consider to be acceptable as far as terms of like what I would need also kind of affects that demand slider mm-hmm. over here. And I mean, the Soviet Union did a great job of showing how if you set the bar low enough for people where they're happy getting bread, you actually don't need to generate very much in your broken economy. And yeah, I'm taking shots at the commies on this one because that's absolutely what happened. There are plenty of very, very happy Soviets, thanks to propaganda, who are just really happy to get their bread and vodka. And who needs a car? Am I right? Like, you know, shame on you for even wanting that. You know, that's a very capitalist pig mindset to have, you know. But it's kind of true how that worked. Like, you didn't need a very efficient system if the demand was low enough, and you can artificially shunt the demand by encouraging people to want less, you know? And that does work in some societies. Like, look at these closed societies like Amish people and Mennonites. They don't have very high demands, and so they don't need a robust economy of, you know, generating things, not because they're not growing, because they have a lot of kids and they do grow, but because the demand is just incredibly low because they don't want or are prohibited by their religion to have all these extra things. And that's a big part of their way of life, to be very content with what little you do have. And so in theory, there would be nothing to say that the entire world couldn't adopt that kind of mentality. And there just would not be a whole lot that needs to get done. And you just sit there. Now, I'm not advocating that necessarily, but saying that having a wooden home and a horse and carriage, that's just a place on the slider. We could move that slider up to, you know, 2,000 square foot home, 2 vehicles, and this much of a grocery budget, and the same principle should apply. Now, the amount of resource generation would need to match that, but in theory, we could. And as a part of growing an economy, the other ways you can kind of, so we talked about how you can change the demand side. The way the supply side is shifting all the time is increases in efficiency are a large part of how we can actually grow our economies, doing more with less, yielding more that was formerly waste. I mean, diesel as a form of fuel kind of came out of that. It used to be a discarded byproduct until someone figured out this thing that's essentially dirt cheap that we're making can actually just be what we use for something else. And now all of a sudden the refineries are twice as profitable, maybe not twice, but because now we're generating two sources of fuel instead of just one with a ton of byproduct, right? And you see this happen all the time, where creative people are taking a waste product and making it into a commodity. That is like one of the, if you want to go out and make a big difference in the world and you don't want to be very creative, I feel like that's a very easy way to do it. Instead of looking for a problem to solve, look for what is currently garbage and see if you can make something that people would want to buy out of that garbage.
How do I literally turn this trash into treasure? Yeah.
Yeah. That it is shocking how many companies are literally built around that premise. It's a lot, you know? So yeah, I guess that was my thing, as I was thinking, you know, if consumerism did die down and we did not need to make as much, would that, mixed with other things that are currently built into like the Western economies, start to crumble, not because we weren't able to make enough, but because the financial system, which is built around this to help facilitate this, seems to be keenly built on like lending and, you know, profit and like the
growth.
Yeah. It's so built on growth where it actually is bad for your economy to reach steady state, arguably, if you look at it purely from that system, because loans no longer need to be taken out. There's no money to be made on just holding on to things that generate wealth in the same way. Like, you're not going to see increased profits. You're going to see the same profit. So there's very little sense in, you know, there's less speculating. You don't need to like raise capital to do the thing you need to do. It's just you have to go earn it to buy stock. And all that you're buying is essentially, when stocks become no different than bonds, you know, you don't need to speculate. It makes very little sense to ever take a loan out in that case, because you're just going to take out a loan to buy something that's paying you an interest that better be higher than the loan. But if that's the case, why is the person who's lending you money not just buying the same thing? Mm-hmm. Right? Like, if I had a stock that I knew for, if I had a bond that I knew for sure was going to appreciate at like 4% and you're loaning money out for 2%, then that's just a no-brainer deal. But then the question is, why didn't you just buy the bond?
Right.
Because you'd make more money than lending it to me for 2%, you know? And that's where you, I think...
Well, I think if an economy reaches steady state, you won't see bonds, right?
No, and that's the whole point.
That's the thing, because a bond is just saying, lend me money, please, right?
Right. And
but if nobody needs to borrow money, there's not going to be bonds. So then, yeah, your stocks become just the way to tap into the productive companies that there are. Yeah, and as your way of being able to earn money in retirement when you can't work.
Right. But that's like such a small part of what the current financial system does.
Mm-hmm.
And weirdly, the amount of capital concentrated in the financial sector, it's become a pillar of the economy in and of itself. It generates wealth by generating wealth, by encouraging and spurning growth, hopefully, right? And if you don't have growth, then you don't have any of that. But there are so many people, like the number of people whose earned income is on the back of profit income in that way.
Okay, what do you mean by profit income, though?
Okay, by profit income, I mean you, it's similar to appreciated income. So profit income is like, I own a business, and I'm not making money on the value of the business. I'm making money on the wealth that business generates. So that's profit income in my mind. So like, if you...
Okay. Cash flow.
Yes. But it's not due... But I'm not doing anything now to earn that cash flow. I may have set up the business. I may have done a bunch of things, but it's on autopilot. Right.
You set up a system that earns money. Yeah.
And I'm just collecting money off of that system.
Okay.
Right. Very capitalist of me in that way. But not as much as the other kind, which is asset income, which is I'm making money because I lent money into this thing and I'm receiving, I own a part of, it's similar to profit income, but like one step removed, I guess, is what I would say. Like, it's not tied to how much money the business makes necessarily, it's tied more to the valuation of the business if it were to sell.
Okay, well, I mean, so the business owner in your simple case also has that, right? That business does have a value that somebody would pay to just own it, right?
But you never exchange for it. And that's, it doesn't become that.
That's just
that.
A personal choice, though.
Correct. But it's just so. Which
but if I'm a stockholder in a company, I can also make that choice and say, no, I'm just happy with the dividend the stock is paying and I'm not going to sell it.
Right. Yeah. Essentially. So again, they're lopped together in passive income.
There are two primary ways that people invest in stocks.
Yeah.
One is to get the profits that they're distributing. And the other is to speculate on its future value, hoping to be able to sell the stock itself for a profit.
Right. And then there's lending, which is, I'm just giving you money to collect interest.
Right.
And in a perfect world, you'd pay your payments and I would collect an interest. But there is risk involved here, just like there's risk involved in the other forms of passive
income. Yeah, every form of investing has risks. Yeah.
Yeah. And... I guess the way I'm trying to contextualize this conversation and the way I'm thinking about it is if the only way to reach that steady state happiness for the person is to be involved in a growth-like system, I think that's a dangerous thing to hinge your economy on, is to always having to be growing or people start...
I agree.
Not being able to... You know, you see what I'm saying?
I think the place where this goes is that people have to wise up and realize that you can't hinge your future on growth.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is why I kind of, I don't, okay. All right. Before we continue, this is the time for the generic disclaimer. Nothing that we're saying in this episode is financial advice. And if you want advice on how to invest your money, go somewhere else.
We are not certified financial advisors, nor fiduciaries.
We have no fiduciary responsibility to help you in your financial future. Do not complain if you take any of our advice, which isn't advice, by the way. If you hear anything in this episode that makes you inclined to make a financial decision, that is your own fault if it goes south.
Yes.
Okay, now that we have that out of the way,
yeah,
this is why I don't like speculative investing, because I think it is ultimately unsustainable in that way, because infinite growth is impossible.
Right.
But if we're talking, but that's kind of just a personal thing, mm-hmm. right? I'm thinking about me. I don't want to hinge my future on speculation about future growth. I would rather have stocks that are paying consistent dividends and just be collecting the cash as it comes in, even if today I am earning less than I could if I speculated.
Right.
But it's more sustainable. And so I think that's ultimately where our future would have to go. So if we assume that we can never go back to a time, if we assume that today it's impossible to reach that happy place with only your earned income, which arguably it is, then I think the most responsible thing to do is to go into those more stable forms of income that are just part of the economy that are paying money out to their owners.
Mm-hmm.
Then the only problem becomes, again, what is the population up to? So, yeah. And I don't, and in this case, I don't necessarily mean just the number. I also mean the age of the population.
Right.
Because yeah, the place where all this matters is, yeah, okay, you need income from a source that doesn't involve working so that you can get what you want out of life, but also so that you can have income in your retirement.
Mm-hmm.
Because this can also, the nature of these things is to snowball.
Yep.
So you're eventually going to get so much that you don't have to work at all anymore to be in that happy place. But if everybody does that, then nobody is working and all these things collapse.
Right.
So then it matters, okay, how long are people living? You know, if the population is constantly cycling in and out, then it's fine. There will always be a population of the younger folks who don't have any money, who are working, doing the work to generate all this money for the people who are in retirement and not doing anything.
Sort of. I think it's a ratio, though. Like, I think we've all seen those charts of, like, you know, the population by segment, right?
Yeah.
Where it's like essentially you have like 0 to 16, which is useless drains on the economy.
Yes.
But potential, you know, they have potential, mm-hmm. but they're right now they're useless. They're dead weights. Arguably always will be. And then, or maybe 14, depends on how woke we
sure, whatever.
Is. Yeah. And then you have like your unskilled, no experience people, which are valuable just because that's usually where the curve starts to get bigger in population. And then you have the more skilled, and then you have like your peak income level or your peak valued workers, which are your 40 to 50 somethings. They have the most experience they're going to get before they start retiring. And in theory, they should be able to generate way more earned income than anyone else. And then right above them in the 50 to 60s, it starts to taper because they start to retire.
And then into the 60s, it just goes down to zero.
And ideally, people start dying off at this age. And so this population group gets smaller and smaller. And in a model where you have like retirements that aren't necessarily tied to a fixed payout, this is good because everyone that dies before they collect is putting money back into a system that's going to filter into someone else.
Right.
But if you achieve an ultimate steady state society where the birth rate matches the death rate and it's very predictable, you get a column. So the ratio of earners to non-earners anymore, or like collectors, kind of reaches this 3-to-1 ratio. Depending on how you want to bracket it out, right? If you have like one bracket for the non-earners that's aged appropriately in the right breakdown, it's maybe 2-to-1. But what essentially that means is that two people have to work together to generate enough so that they can be happy in their consumption, and so can one other person.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is currently how the Ponzi scheme of the Social Security works. And it was kind of built in a time when, well, yeah, there's way more, you know, it was like a 30-to-1 ratio. It's not a huge burden on the resource generation side. But as you reach a steady state, it becomes more and more and more burdensome as well. You know what I mean? So I guess that's my two cents on like what the people doing, what the society do.
Yeah. I think the fundamental difference between this and Social Security is that you literally are buying your way into the system and you get out of it proportional to what you put in.
True.
Whereas in Social Security, you put in something, you put in proportional to what you earn, and then you just take out a constant amount for as long as you stay alive.
Yeah.
And that doesn't necessarily add up the same way.
No. Well, and I think also, I mean, this is another thing. Money sitting in accounts is bad for the economy. We're told that a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Money not moving bad. But how much of that is built on the mindset of, we need to be lending money out to spur growth, and how much of it is just in general a bad thing for the economy? Because money sitting means that things were generated but not consumed.
But money sitting in stocks is not just sitting.
That's true. But if you reached a steady state where, like, I guess at that point, like, why would a company issue more stocks?
They don't need to.
But is there enough stock to go around for you to actually do that if everybody was doing that, if you reached a steady state economy?
Sure. Why not?
I mean, I don't know. That's why I'm asking. I don't, like I said, I'm not an economist.
Well, the number of shares doesn't really matter. It just matters. The only thing that really matters is the yield proportional to how much money you put in.
Sure. But I guess, okay, let me think about it this way. Why does a company issue stock in the first place?
They want to sell those shares to get money to do other things.
But if you're reaching a steady state where you don't need to do other things, why would they not buy back those shares and not have them at all? Again, we're like heavily ham-fisting this in.
I guess I get that, but those shares are already out on the open market, so they're going to have to compete against the open market to buy those back.
Sure. But still, if you're a business entity, right, that's mm-hmm. going to live way longer than a person, it makes sense to do it, even if it's prohibitively expensive in the short and even maybe in the midterm. But in the longest term...
Yeah, but who's to say, okay, who's to say that those folks have any more motivation than anybody else to buy those stocks, to buy the shares?
Well, they don't. But at some point, it becomes cost prohibitive for anybody else to even bother buying the share for the dividend because you're not going to live long enough to collect.
Well, you will collect, but the yield is going down because now the share price is going up because there's high demand.
Yeah.
Like, that's the thing. If the company decides, okay, now we're going to buy back all of our shares, they just created a huge spike in demand and the price goes up. Which makes their task even harder for them.
Sure. But it still reduces the amount of... I guess the question I have is...
But also, again, you're also kind of pretending that just goes into a black box, and it doesn't. Those shares are still paying their dividend to their owners.
Right.
Well, those owners are just people in the economy like any other shareholder.
Right.
It will find its way to recirculate the same way that any other... Okay, me, not a participant in the business, I own stocks, okay... Now I reach the end of my life. Those go somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
They will get sold to somebody else.
Right.
So like I don't know why you think that the people who have a direct interest in the business have like more interest in getting shares than anybody else.
That's
why the shares don't just stay in the economy.
That's a good point. I guess the assumption I'm having here is that I'm adding a new constraint that. I didn't explicitly say before, because this is fundamentally true as well. I don't think you'll ever get an entire populace to reach a point where it's like, I'm content with X.
Mm-hmm.
There's always going to be margins on the bell curve of people totally happy with less and people not happy with more, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because there are the number go up people that, like, good example, there are people out there worth $1 billion who are still trying to figure out ways to make more money.
Right.
For some reason. Because right. That's just what they do.
It's just the game they're playing, yeah.
Right. Their happiness is derived not from the things they buy with that $1 billion, but having $1 billion.
Right.
Or more. Which, cool, I guess, but who cares? You know? And this is usually like the billionaire class that I think that every commie hates. And it's like, okay, but still, you know, and I guess that's the only reason why I think that would be a thing. But ultimately, you know, I think does that actually become prohibitive to those who just want to live on earned income or not? Like, or can they both exist and be fine? You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
'Cause I don't like the idea that like it's the billionaires are why it's hard to make mid-income and be happy. I don't generally like that mentality because you're putting a lot on a very few people. And it's also not a zero-sum game necessarily. And if you treat it that way, maybe there's an argument, but it isn't. But how much of this problem of people are not able to get to mid-income and just be happy is due to the billionaire class? I don't think that it's a significant amount, right?
I don't think so either.
Yeah. So yeah, maybe that's the only reason why I was thinking that the black box would just keep consuming because...
Yeah, there are definitely economic forces at play that are making life more expensive today than before and things like that. But no, I don't think the answer is just, oh, the billionaires are hoarding all the money.
Right. I think one thing that might be somewhat contributing to it is, like, again, if we go back to our assumptions here, the economy is going to keep getting more efficient just because it does, and there's more money to be made. But at some point, you know, I think it gets down to where, how do you fractionally split jobs in a way? Like, a good example, trucking. There's no reason why you can't be a 50-hour-a-week trucker. But if you could make... If the incentive curve for being a trucker is, I can truck 20 hours a week and make a good living and then reach that point where it's like, I would rather just, in the way that we talk about right now, it's like, I'm not working on the weekends because I've made enough money that I'm happy. Well, one way you can still get as much trucking done that's necessary is just employ twice the number of truckers, but have them do half as much work each. And they would all still be, if you can shift it from 40 hours a week down to 20 hours a week, you could reach a point in time where, and I think this is ultimately, I think what, if the system, if we went to where I would think we would want to go, where most people are just content, if they could just do that fractionally, then that's kind of a win. I mean, it's not one-to-one because the more time you have to spend money, you know, like earning twice as much doesn't mean you don't need to work half as much. It's more maybe like a third as much because you're spending more than you're probably making on your off days. But I would hope that that's where we would want to go as opposed to everybody who can work. Because I guess what I'm worried about, and maybe I'm really ignorant for worrying about this, but what I worry about is getting into a financial situation in which, or an economic situation in which anybody who can work gets to live like a king, but everyone else is just unemployable. You know what I'm saying? And so this was my fear when I was looking at like our good friend CGP Gray, who's not our friend because he doesn't know who we exist. His Humans Need Not Apply video, mm-hmm. where he talks about automation. All that's going to do is make any employable human more valuable, relatively speaking, because the spending capacity of the average goes down because more people aren't employed. But those who can't work are just destitute. And so you really do end up with this kind of wonky society.
Well, I mean, okay, this is the rug that I was getting ready to pull at the end of the episode, which I guess we're kind of at now, which is that I don't think any of this conversation actually matters.
Maybe not.
Because I think post-scarcity society is going to be here before any of this could ever take effect.
Maybe. But what if it isn't, though? Like, that's the thing. Mm-hmm. It's like, what happens if it isn't? Like, what if it turns out it's way easier? Like, the automation curve is... The automation difficulty curve is exponential, where it's actually easy to automate maybe a quarter of the economy, but then it's our capacity to automate drastically slows down. You know, I think that's when you would see trouble.
I agree. I agree. And the thing that I've always said about post-scarcity society is that the before is fine. The after is fine. It's the in between that gets really dangerous.
Yeah.
Did we ever do an episode on post-scarcity society?
I think
if we did, it was a long time ago.
Yeah, I think we did, but it was a long time ago.
Yeah.
It might be worth a refresh at some point.
It might be worth revisiting that and talking about ways to potentially transition to a post-scarcity society. So, but I don't know. Yeah, maybe a story for another time.
Yeah. Because, again, this is like mostly driving down the highway with a long road to go and having way too much time to just think about stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I do get how it's easy to fall into this idea of like, man, anybody who can put in 40 hours a week deserves X, Y, and Z, because we should be able to generate that if we're able to generate as much as we do. How you get to that point, and that's where I think people start thinking about how do we redistribute the wealth to make sure that that's possible.
I would like to also interject about, oh, anyone should be able to work 40 hours a week and get what they need. Disagree, actually. People back in the before times, the 40-hour work week did not exist.
Mm-hmm.
People made it on their own means, but they were working every waking hour of the day, basically.
Right.
So let's not fool ourselves that we aren't living in luxury by even having a 40-hour work week and we scrape by with it.
Right. And that's a good point, too.
That just having that is a luxury in and of itself.
Yeah. And I am curious, though, like if we were able to have the perfect economic model that is centrally controlled, like what could you get away with? Like based on our current hard efficiencies, not our financial mm-hmm. modeling, like none of this crap, purely on
how much do we actually have to work to sustain our society?
Right. Like if we truly did say, let's look at the sum, let's assume we have this many people.
Right. We need this many people to work.
We're going to work everybody even.
Equally. This is how many man hours are needed to produce what needs producing for our society. Then divide that by the number of people.
The number of waking hours of people.
Right. Waking hours of people. Okay. Now how many?
What's the ratio?
Right.
Is it 40 out of however many you're awake? Because you're not awake for...
The waking hours doesn't matter. Because if it comes out more than the waking hours, then the answer is we have to work all day and night to get what we need. Which we don't, obviously, but...
Right, so I'm assuming it's less. Yeah.
Yeah, so, yeah, it's how many hours are there in a year? And then how many people are there? Okay, then you need to work this many hours out of a year. We can divide that into whatever time frames that we need or whatever.
Right. Yeah, because that would be an interesting thing to discuss. Because I think some people are very optimistic in thinking that it's 40 or less because that's what's been instituted in the West is 40-hour work weeks.
Yeah, but we just decided that. Yeah.
Yeah, but there's also a lot that's feeding these economies that are not working 40-hour work weeks in all over the world. Mm-hmm. So maybe that is a bit of wishful thinking where it's like, well, but if you took all of these effectively slave labor that's going on elsewhere in the world... and you gave them a 40-hour work week, how instantly more expensive does everything that you have get? And is your 40-hour work week enough to generate the income to do that as well? You know,
yeah, what if the world were on a 40-hour work week? What would change?
that's a good thought. I would want to see a case study on that. That'd be actually very interesting to read, which is what if everybody 40-hour work week and... what would you like? What does the cost of living become with that? Because that's a huge slider that I don't think most people in the West consider is your cost of living is propped up by a vastly inferior standard of living elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause it's easy to think that, well, this whole country of these United States of America is a big place with a lot of people. We should be able to do whatever. It's like, well, but how much of this is propped up by the South China Sea region and 60, 70, 80 hour work weeks in very poor conditions and high death rates and stuff like that, which we don't even want to get into. Yeah. That's a good point. I post-scarcity society is going to be lit. Can't wait.
but it could be messy getting there.
It could be messy getting there. I think that's what we talked about. If we did do an episode, it was like, how do you get to a post-scarcity society? And if not, then that's definitely what we need to talk about. Not just living in a post-scarcity society, but like the transition period, which is going to be rough.
Yep.
Philosophers.
If you like the music in this episode, please check out Jippy on Bandcamp at jippy.bandcamp.com.
Philosophers is supported by viewers like you.
If there's a topic you'd like us to discuss,
or a topic you'd like to see revisited in the future,
please let us know by contacting us using the methods in the description,
or in the comments below. Thank you for listening.